Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Is hair a material?
Are biscuits a material?
Are crystals a material?
Is plastic a material?
Is porridge a material?
Can gases be a material?
Are eggs a material?
Is water a material?
What do you call everything that isn't a material?
Sorry, I didn't mean to laugh at your question.
And yet you continue to do so.
Hello, and welcome back to Handmade, the making podcast with real talk about materials. I'm your host, material scientist Anna Pajewski, and this episode is a very special episode where illustrator and former podcast guest Hannah Ayoub is turning the microphone on me to talk about my new book called Handmade, A Scientist's Search for Meaning Through Making, which is out on the 13th of May. Handmade is all about materials and making. About 4 years ago, I experienced this sort of crushing realization that although I knew all the scientific theories of materials on paper, like what makes steel really hard and strong or what makes glass transparent, I realized that I knew nothing really about what it feels like to forge orange hot steel in a blacksmith's workshop or blow up a bubble of molten glass with my breath. And so, you know, here I was supposed to be the expert in this stuff, but there was this huge gap in my knowledge, which was that of hand making. So 4 years ago, that was the impetus of this podcast, and it's also where the book begins. Not only in the book did I decide to talk to craftspeople, but I actually decided to get my hands dirty and go on a quest to meet the expert craftspeople who work with this stuff every day and have a go at their crafts in search for finding meaning through making. While I was writing the book, I kept noticing that these materials that I was writing about, these 10 materials, intersected with stories from my own life and elements of my identity as well. So it ended up becoming kind of an autobiography. For example, the chapter on plastics tells the story of my Polish granddad George and how his life was shaped by and at times even saved by plastics. The chapter on clay is about how throwing clay on the potter's wheel saved me from depression. And the chapter on sugar is the story of the time that I attempted to swim the English Channel. So that's a bit of the context of what to expect from the book. And I asked Hannah to interview me because she made 12 wonderful illustrations for the book, which appear at the top of every chapter. And for Hannah, you know, as someone as comfortable in the lab as she is in her artist studio, I thought she was the perfect person to kind of really appreciate where the book sits at this confluence of art and craft and science. So Hannah started by asking me how I came to write a book. Well, actually, the book idea stemmed from this podcast. I've been doing the podcast since like early 2017, which is mad to think about now that we're in 2021. And my original idea for it was to, you know, interview people who knew about materials from a different perspective from me. So as a person with a background in material science, I was very familiar with the theories and formulae and sort of the graphs of what materials look like on paper, but I have no idea at all about kind of what they're like in the real world and how they feel and behave sort of under the hand, really. I just sort of knew what it was like theoretically. So the podcast stemmed from that feeling of inadequacy and confusion. And so I wanted to interview materials experts, and that was how the podcast was born. And then in 2017 spring, I went on a swimming holiday with a company called Swim Trek. And I met a woman called Laura McDougall. And I was talking to her about my podcast and the stand-up comedy that I did about material science. And she said, oh, I'm a literary agent. Would you like to write a book with me? So I was like, oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Like I love writing. I'd love to sort of, yeah, think about writing a book. So then I worked with her on the book proposal, and fast forward 4 years later, now I've done a book.
Amazing. Okay, so let's rewind a little bit.
Okay.
So how long did it take to get from that sort of initial idea of writing a book to sort of the actual idea for this book?
Well, the actual idea for this book happened while I was writing this book. Throughout this process, I've found out how to write a book. But because I didn't know how to do that initially, it all happened a bit in reverse. So I knew that I wanted to write about materials, obviously, because that's sort of my area of expertise. But I also knew that I wanted to not just write a straight up, quote unquote, popular science book where I just write about the science and don't bring in any of the other interesting aspects of materials like making, but also like history and sort of societal stuff as well. So I knew that much. And in my... listeners might not realize, but when you want to write a book, you have to write a book proposal, which is sort of a relatively long document. You have to say what chapters you're intending to write, what the sort of headline of the book is about. You have to give a sample of your writing. And in that proposal, I sort of said, well, I'm going to write a chapter on 10 different materials. These are some ideas for the materials. Actually, a lot of those changed in the end book. And that was pretty much it. There wasn't really any sort of overall story arc or purpose to the book other than I'm profiling these 10 materials. And I think I said, I can't even remember in the book proposal whether I said I would actually go and meet makers and artists and craftspeople and have a go at their crafts. I think I probably did, but that wasn't really a sort of main focus of it. And then when I was very lucky to get the deal and sort of sat down to start doing it. I had this realization that actually it would be really nice to have some sort of narrative action going on. So I did go and meet a craftsperson or a few craftspeople for every chapter with each material. Some of which will be familiar to listeners on this podcast. We've got Agnes Jones from very early on. I spent time with her blacksmithing. Darren Ellis, Ellie Doney, Andrew Zeminski, various others as well.
Hello, this is Anna from the future. The full list of craft people featured in the book who have also appeared on this podcast is Charlie Murphy, Agnes Jones, Andy Taylor, Darren Ellis, Ellie Doney, Eleanor Schofield, Zofia Wijemerska-Noga, and Andrew Zeminski.
But that was still sort of quite a linear idea. When I wrote the book, I did every month I wrote one chapter basically. And so by the end of those 12 months, I had these 10 chapters about materials. And then the really fun bit started, which was to try and make it into a story and into some sort of, to give it some purpose, basically. Otherwise, it would just be very repetitive, like, here's brass, now here's clay, now here's wood. So I sort of sat down and I interrogated more my reason for writing the book. And those uncomfortable feelings, like I said earlier, feeling inadequate, feeling like a bit of an imposter. I was supposedly this materials expert, but actually, if you asked me to like throw a pot on the potter's wheel, I'd be useless. Or if you asked me a question about wood, I don't know anything about wood. Like, we don't even study that in material science. Wood's quite an important material, it turns out, for society and for makers. So I really interrogated these feelings of inadequacy and where they came from. And that meant that I then became this protagonist in this story, because no longer was the focus on these 10 different materials, but the focus was on me. And this was the point where I actually settled on the title as well, A Scientist's mm-hmm. Search for Meaning Through Making, because the protagonist holds the reader's hand through this journey. So at the beginning of the book, we sort of meet me, the character. While I was writing it, I had to sort of make myself as a character, which was quite funny because I needed to sort of examine my own mostly character flaws to make a believable mm-hmm. character, which was quite an interesting sort of...
Which I think you have achieved well. The autobiographical side of the book is absolutely lovely and really sort of draws you in and connects you to it. It is a characterized version of you, but yep. I still think it is very you. Like, you do come through in the book, and that's really lovely.
Oh, good.
And
I'm
definitely
pleased.
Isn't true of science books, you know, on the whole, even popular science books.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, as scientists, we're so conditioned to write ourselves out of our work, right? Mm-hmm. The experiment was done. mm-hmm. So I really wanted to get away from that and to put some character into it. So I'm really glad that comes across. It's always tempting, I think, when you write autobiography to just write yourself as this, like, really cool, like, well put together person. But actually, that's not interesting for readers. They want to see the cracks. So,
it's what makes people more likable, isn't it?
And definitely, yeah, I think it's relatable.
It's absolutely delightful. I mean, I had someone say to me recently, you know, you do have to realise you don't have to put yourself into your writing. And I was sort of, well, then why am I writing? If it's not at least, if I'm not placing myself in the writing, if I'm not bringing some of me to the reader, then why am I writing it?
What's
why
the point
isn't someone else writing
exactly,
it?
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's a really important point. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And when you're trying to sell a book to a publisher, a big question is why you? Why are you the mm-hmm. person to write this?
Yeah. I would say that I think you're the perfect person to have written this book. I think we've talked about, you know, the interviews, the sort of meeting these craftspeople, these characters, your sort of personal story, and then also, of course, the science that's in it as well. And I think bringing all of those threads together has created a really beautiful story with lots of science and making in there.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Yeah. That's really nice.
So you've mentioned that there are some people in the book that podcast listeners will be familiar with. Mm-hmm. Do you want to say anything more about those sort of episodes or those materials that people will see in the book?
Yeah. So some of the interviews that you'll hear on the podcast most recently were ones that I did alongside writing the book, which was mostly done in 2019. So with the early ones like Agnes Jones and Darren Ellis, I'd interviewed them on the podcast already. And so when I was writing the book and wanting to reach out to makers, they were great people because I already knew that they would be we were already sort of pals. So it was really nice, actually, with the Agnes Jones example. She was an early interviewee on the podcast. And then I reached out to her and went up to visit her in Glasgow at her studio. And it was a lovely experience to spend another day with her and really sort of watch her at work, watch her in her sort of natural habitat of her forge and have a go myself, which was I'd say blacksmithing is probably one of the most dramatic crafts that I tried of all of the ones that I did. Very, very dark. The space has to be kept very dark so that you can see the colour of the steel, but then also like really loud and very hot, quite sort of scary at times because there's this like red glowing hot metal around flinging bits of like hammer scale off at you every time you hit it, and really tiring as well. Like I thought I'd be quite well I had a grandiose idea that I thought I'd be relatively good at blacksmithing because I like to think that I've got quite good upper body strength, but actually it's all in the technique and I was very rubbish.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you talked about sort of, you know, showing your flaws as a character. And I think those stories of you actually getting to make things and learning from the craftspeople really brings that out, because you are showing sort of the inadequacy or the sort of, you know, you're learning something. And that's such a journey for a reader to join you on and, you know, for you to be really honest about.
And actually, that was important to me because I think a lot of popular science books are written generally by people at towards the top of their game, not exclusively. There are lots of brilliant younger writers coming through, but traditionally it's people, you know, at the top of their careers. They're the knowledge holders and they are disseminating this knowledge to us, the lowly public, right? So there's this sort of hierarchy of expert and non-expert and knowledge flow going sort of downhill that way. Whereas with this book, I wanted to be on the side of the reader. Like, I don't know anything about blacksmithing either. Let's learn together.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that for me was an important distinction to kind of be at the naive end and be having these experiences new.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any sort of favourite making experiences that you covered in the book? You mentioned blacksmithing, but were there any others?
Oh my gosh, so many. Glass blowing was phenomenal. I'd never had a chance to sort of soften glass and work with it, but it's such a weird material because it's not crystalline. It doesn't have a distinct melting temperature like ice does, or actually any metals. It's sort of, as you heat it, it just becomes softer and softer and softer until it becomes liquid enough for you to be able to sort of move it around and manipulate it. And as I was having a go, actually Charlie Murphy is another guest on this podcast who I worked with glass for the book. As I was heating this glass, you could sort of feel it start to give under your hands, but nothing visual changes with the material as well. So it's really weird. You sort of just have to feel it. Just go by what you can feel and the sort of resistance of the material. And sometimes you heat it too fast and then it goes way too liquid and then it all happens really quickly. It like flops off onto the floor or something. But that was exactly what I was trying to get at with the book, was this sort of feeling of literally hands-on, but also experiencing the material from using a different sense, using the sense of touch and feeling. That was a really, really special experience.
It's really interesting to hear that, because I'd say I've always been a crafter and worked with loads of different materials. And to me, that's unsurprising, this idea that you do feel your material, you predict things, you sometimes can't quite explain what's going on, but you know something's about to snap, or you know that something's just right. You mentioned about glass sort of not being a crystalline material. So I'm just going to pick up on that. Can you explain for anyone who doesn't know what that means?
Of course. So let's get into the material science of this. firstly, you know, all materials are made of atoms. And the way that material scientists think of materials is they like to imagine what those atoms are up to inside and how they arrange themselves. In lots of materials like metals and ice, the atoms line up in a very sort of regimented structure. So if you can imagine sort of like a 3D grid of all these atoms, which I usually think of as sort of like little balls. So if you imagine a whole load of marbles or maybe Maltesers sort of stacked up in a really neat rows and columns in a sort of 3D structure, we describe that as a crystal structure in material science. So crystalline materials have these very ordered and regimented atoms. And that's what gives them a melting temperature, because when you heat these materials, the bonds between the atoms are all the same strength. They all have the same relationships between each other. So when you heat the material and the bonds break, that is what causes the material to go from a solid material to a liquid. With glass, there are no rows and columns of atoms. There are no sort of, there's no order to it really. Although strictly speaking, material scientists would say that there's short range order, but we'll forget about that. so in glass, what you have is these quite big silica molecules, and they arrange themselves in a very chaotic and disordered way. And the result of that is that there is no one particular temperature which can break those bonds, because they're all different. And so what you end up with is a range over a temperature range. Those bonds start to become broken, and as more and more bonds are broken, the material becomes more and more liquid. But there is no one distinct, this glass melts at 100 degrees or 1,000 degrees or whatever.
Interesting. So we've talked a bit about this sort of divide between science and crafting, you know, the sort of the making versus sort of the, you know, the graphs on paper. Are you hoping that the book will help people to see more of these connections?
Definitely. Because, you know, as I was going through the process of learning about all these crafts, I was making all these scientific connections. For example, in the chapter about wool, I went to a wool dyeing workshop at the Wool Kitchen and the London Loom up in Hackney. And we were doing acid dyeing, which is sort of the one of the most common ways of dyeing wool. And what happens in acid dyeing is you have these dye molecules, and when you put them in water, they split into a positively charged bit and a negatively charged bit. And I can't remember which way around it is now, but one of those is the bit that holds the colour. And that's the one that ends up being attracted to the strands in the wool. And so there's chemistry behind that. And yet that is a really sort of traditional crafting technique. Mm. And again, with blacksmithing as well, you know, I understood the science behind incandescence and why materials glow when they get hot. That's all to do with quantum mechanics and electromagnetics. But to see it, and for Agnes to say, right, that's at 1500 degrees now because it's glowing orange, let's get it out of the forge and start hitting it. Those kinds of connections is what I wanted to bring and to sort of show readers that these are just two ways of thinking about the same stuff, you know, literally stuff, materials, but also kind of the same ideas and history and objects and all of this sort of stuff. So, yeah, I suppose I wanted to show that it's just different perspectives, but in doing that, hopefully, if people are coming at this from more of the scientific side, then it will give them the confidence to think, maybe I can enter the world of craft. And likewise, if people are coming at this who tend to identify as artists, then hopefully it will lower the barriers to entry of thinking about materials scientifically and interrogating the processes that they experience as they're doing their artistic practice.
I guess when we're talking about this science and art sort of, you know, divide as well, I think we quite often get people who are sort of one or the other, but also people who are neither. And I think the nice thing about making and the topics you're covering, so things like wood and blacksmithing and wool, these are actually materials that everyone's going to have some familiarity with. You know, this isn't sort of high art. This is literally the art that makes the things we all use.
Yep.
And I think that's sort of even more sort of breaking down barriers, I think, and boundaries between things.
Yeah, definitely. And the other element of this all is that, you know, you mentioned this earlier that it's a very autobiographical book. Mm. And I think what I wanted to highlight was that these materials have sort of intersected with various elements of my life and areas of my identity. And my hope is that readers will identify how materials have done that in their lives too. So it's not just about whether it's, you know, we think about this as a scientist or an artist, but actually as a person and a human going about the world.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Yeah, I really love that idea. I think there's especially, you know, reading about sugar, and I think also reading about wood, because it's a material I've worked with more, I definitely felt that connection and thinking about, you know, handling objects you're making, but also handling finished objects, you know, treasured things that are sort of part of your family or something that you've been given by someone else. I think there's, I mean, you know, you sort of referred to it as stuff, but the stuff around us tends to be quite important to us.
Definitely.
Yeah. How did the sort of craftspeople that you worked with, what did they think about this idea of sort of talking about the science within it, or, you know, having this material scientist who'd never touched these materials before sort of coming into their studios and workplaces?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it was quite varied, to be honest. Mm. I think I'm always a bit wary of sort of outing myself as a material scientist, because I think it does put barriers up with, you know, people from certain sort of expertise. So I didn't want them to feel like I was being at the worst judgmental, but at the very least sort of that I wasn't coming at this from like a place of just complete openness and wanting to learn. And from a place of complete naivety. Like, I didn't want to think that I was, you know, taking notes for any sort of like scientific reason. So I think there was an element of having to gain trust between us. Mm-hmm. And once they saw how crap I was at making stuff, then they were fine. They were like, oh, here's a complete beginner idiot. Now I know where to put her. but in general, I think the majority of the makers that I met and spent time with, they are fascinated by the scientific elements and the crossovers and wanting to hear about, just as I am, how the other side thinks in a way. And, you know, identifying the scientific elements of the crafts that they do. Yeah.
I think that trust really comes through in the book as well. And I know you're the sort of narrator, but you do also get this sense of the other people in the book and some of their personalities and their sort of, you know, we talked about sort of full-rounded characters, but the bits that they love about what they do, the bits they might not, you know, love as much. And that really does come through. I think one of my favourites is in the stone chapter, because you literally go on a bit of a journey with the person who's the maker, whose name I've completely forgotten.
Andrew Zeminski.
Okay, but yeah. You know, you sort of start off with the sort of conserving a monument, and then you go on a drive and you go to his workplace. It's a really nice sort of multi-part sort of journey in that one.
Yeah. Oh, thanks. It's funny actually. A lot of the descriptions that have been coming in the sort of marketing side of the book have said it's a science book / memoir / travel log. Like, they're really emphasizing the travel aspect, which I didn't really think about. But I suppose, yeah, there is quite an element of travel. And I do travel the country to meet these people, you know, up to Glasgow to see Agnes, to the West Country with Andrew. I go to Norfolk to meet Andy Taylor, the trumpet maker. It has been, and Dorset as well for the iron port. So it has been all around the country. I hadn't really thought about that.
and you do talk about those journeys, and I think you talk about where you are and what the weather's like in some cases. So yeah. I can see that travel side. Like, I felt like I was going on a bit of a journey around the UK whilst reading the book.
Oh, good.
Especially during, you know, lockdown, when I haven't left London for a year. So it was really nice.
Yeah. That is one concern with the book, actually, is that it's very much obviously written and set in 2019, because there's going on trains and shaking hands and touching the same clay, all of which is banned now. So,
I don't know. I think I would hope that adds a bit of a sort of escapist angle to it. I mean, definitely, I've started reading a lot more over the last few months, and it's felt like a really nice way to get out of this feeling of, you know, being trapped in the same place and be able to see different worlds and different places and sort of meet new people in a way through pages. So I think
And actually, it's funny, when I wrote the first version of the stone chapter, I wrote that one last in pretty much February, March 2020, And one of the first version of the chapter was, it was quite bad tempered because I was writing it during the very beginning of the lockdown. And it was also, I wrote in COVID into that chapter. Mm. You know, I'm sitting on the train and I see a thing flash up on my phone and it's the first six deaths from COVID in the UK and stuff. So there's that sort of like element of jeopardy and sort of uncomfortableness.
Mm.
And the reason I wrote that initially was because for me, stone is quite an uncomfortable material because I'm very scared of heights. And the chapter opens with me going up St. Paul's Cathedral and discovering this. And so mistrusting stone. But I ended up taking that COVID element out because, A, it dated the book in time. But also, I think, like you say, we don't really want to keep being reminded of this stuff.
Yeah.
Especially with a year on now, like the majority of people are relatively sick of it. So yeah, I wanted it to kind of stand alone and not be too bogged down in the current affairs.
I remember reading the first version of that chapter and it was uncomfortable. And I think at the time it felt right.
Exactly.
But I think I'm quite glad that you sort of changed it to a sort of a different version. I think especially because it's at the end of the book.
Yeah.
It's sort of nice not to end on a downer and sort of pick up a little bit. anything we haven't spoken about that you'd like to cover?
One of the things, and it's difficult for me to know whether I'm just saying this retrospectively, but no, I think it was there from the beginning, was that I wanted to write I wrote the book that I couldn't see in the popular science field. Nowhere have I ever seen a popular science book written by someone like me, whom I really related to. So that was a real reason, or a real driver for me bringing so much of the personal elements into the book as well, is that I wanted to paint a full picture of what it means to be, or what it is possible to be a scientist as, really. So, you know, yes, I'm interested in material science, but I also really love the trumpet and swimming. And I like going on adventures in my camper van. and all these other things that I'm really, really passionate about. Other elements of my identity, like the story of my Polish granddad in the plastics chapter, the sort of family history side, the sexuality side. I just wanted to form an image of a human who happens to be a scientist.
I think it really does come across that you are a fully rounded person. I mean, we talked about sort of character flaws, but quite often, even the science books that are a bit autobiographical, they're very much about the person as a scientist or the person as an engineer. And I mean, personally, I want to read about someone who likes swimming and goes camping and, you know, I want to know what their favourite sweets are and, you know, the fact that they are slightly obsessed with the weather wherever they're travelling to.
That's hilarious. I had not picked that up.
I mean, it's just a British thing, right?
Or maybe I'm just trying to reach the word count. Who can say?
Who knows? But you really do get this sense of this, you know, this person who's interested in her family history, who's, loves something. All it's a really nice sort of rich sort of experience that you get to go on in the book. And that's really, good. I think, its biggest strength.
The other thing about that is that I didn't want the science to be the central narrative to the book, which I think is what so many popular science books are, because that makes sense as to why they would be like that. But what I wanted to do was, I assumed, my key assumption when starting was that nobody is interested in material science, nor should they be, right? Unless you're paid to do it, like I have been. Science isn't inherently interesting, in my opinion. What's interesting is the repercussions of it, and how it like actually manifests in the real world and how that affects our lives. So I didn't want the central narrative to be, this is glass. Here's the history of glass. Here's the science of glass. I wanted the central narrative to be, I'm a scientist. This is how glass has impacted my life as a scientist. And ditto with, you know, all of the other chapters. So the central spine of every chapter is a non-scientific story. And then we hook on the science and the other sort of historical anecdotes as we go. But I just didn't. For me, that driving narrative is what makes it, is what keeps it going, and keeps a reader's interest Whereas I just don't think science is interesting enough to be able to do that on its own.
I mean, you laugh, but I think we both share this thing that we're a bit irreverent about science. We tend to be quite honest that it's not our entire lives. You know, we have other hobbies, we have other things we're interested in. And for me, a lot, like, I genuinely struggle to read some popular science books because it's rammed full of science. I don't remember most of it right after I've read it, you know. Yeah. And actually, I much prefer to read books with a little bit less science, a bit more story and humanity. And then I tend to remember far more of the science that I've read in the book.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, during the writing process, there were definitely bits where I culled a whole load of science because it wasn't relevant to the story. It wasn't answering any question in the story. The only science in the book enhances the non-scientific stories. If it's just a, here's an interesting thing, then it's cut because it doesn't matter.
Yeah. I think what's interesting as well is you mentioned about not seeing yourself in any other science books. And I, just saying that about wanting books with less science and more story, I've noticed that a lot of, you know, traditionally underrepresented science writers seem to be the ones who do write those books that I personally find sort of richer and more autobiographical and more interesting. And I think that I really hope that that's sort of a trend that keeps continuing and we keep seeing sort of more of these stories that sort of intersect with science.
Oh, me too. Yeah, I can't wait to read those. Yeah. Can we talk about illustrations now?
Yes, we can talk about illustrations. So the reason why I've read Anna's book, including earlier versions of chapters, is that I did the chapter illustrations for the book.
Yeah.
And they, honestly, I think one of, as a collective, one of the favourite things I have ever produced in my career. Like, I say that and I actually start to tear up a bit because it was such an enjoyable thing to work on.
Oh, good. That's really touching to me because it was really important to me to be able to promote and celebrate as much work of the people around me that I admire and enjoy as possible. So I was so thrilled that you were able to do it. And I'd really love to hear from you, because I've not actually asked you this. What was your approach to it, I guess? You know, because I just handed you this 200-page manuscript. Here you go, be artistic.
So... So the interesting thing that I sort of discovered around the time that you handed me the manuscript was that it isn't normal for illustrators to read the books that they're illustrating.
What?
If it's sort of, you know, a full length sort of book aimed at adults, quite often they're just given, you know, obviously with children's books it's different, but it's quite normal for illustrators to just be given a list of illustrations, maybe to have a chat with, you know, the publisher and the writer, but then to go with it. Whereas in a way, I guess, because I knew you before I was brought on board, I knew I was going to read the whole book because I wanted to read it anyway. And so I think my approach started by, I remember I pretty much cycled up the road to a park, lay out in the sun and like read half the book.
Oh, amazing.
And then I think did the same in the garden the next day. And those sort of themes that we've been talking about already, so, you know, the sort of hands-on making but with that sprinkle of science plus the life story and, you know, the you in it, all really came through. And so then as we started to discuss what the individual illustrations would be, those were the things that I wanted to be sort of at the core of them. So I think with every illustration in the book, there's a picture that it's, you know, meant to be of. But then in a slightly sort of abstract way, it's then sort of bringing in lots of hidden scientific elements, lots of things related to you and your life in the book as well. And I've been looking back at the illustrations today, actually, knowing that we were going to be chatting, and it's really nice to actually like look back and be like, yeah, I think I did that. I think I did bring all those elements together in almost every one of these pictures.
Definitely. And it's what made you such a perfect candidate for doing these illustrations, is because, you know, before this project, your work was already bringing in all of those sort of different elements. You know, you that was sort of your, or how I saw it anyway, was one of your sort of key USPs, was that you drew these illustrations that brought in elements of your identity, actually, and your scientific mm-hmm. background and artistic background and interests in pattern and symmetry, but also biology and there's lots of animals that you've done before. So, I mean, it was just, for me, it was a perfect sort of stepping stone into sort of the world of material science and making.
Yeah, I feel like we both sort of work in this sort of area of overlap between sort of science and art and making, and it really felt that sort of we could sort of work in parallel in a way on this, and being able to bring all those things together was really nice. And I really like that the illustrations will be able to work on multiple levels. So, you know, I don't think you need to get every reference or, you know, every pattern that's actually been inspired by a crystal structure to be able to appreciate them. But I also hope that there are going to be little things in there that other people do notice. So, for example, in the picture that accompanies the chapter on, is it the chapter on steel with blacksmithing, or is that a different? You know, the sort of the piece of metal that's being hammered, the pattern changes with the temperature, you know, along that piece of metal. And there's other little things like, you know, the jelly babies have sort of a pattern on them that's inspired by the structure of different sugars. And I hope that, you know, some people might go back and see those patterns as they read through the book. And I hope that, you know, for some of maybe the sciencier people out there, they might pick them up the first time that they see the pictures.
Definitely. I was just going to say that, actually. I think because the chapters appear at the top of, sorry, the illustrations appear at the top of every chapter, and then you sort of read the chapter. So I would definitely be tempted to then flick back and see, like, oh, that there's a polymer molecule. In that plane's wing.
Do you have a favourite out of all the illustrations?
Oh my gosh, that's such a hard question. The sugar one makes me laugh every time because you've done my crew. So for listeners, the sugar chapter is the story of my English Channel swim. And so the illustration is a little me and then some waves, which is a nod to the thing that we make in the chapter. And then there's a boat with two jelly babies on it, which are my crew members. And it just makes me smile every time that, like, you've made my friends into jelly babies.
I mean, I feel like it's particularly relevant given that they were handing you jelly babies.
It's true. I mean, it's true. It's perfect. So that one really makes me smile. But I do love the blacksmithing one because it's so, or the steel chapter one because it's so visceral, and the fire is beautiful and the patterns are fantastic. And then the ones at the start and the end, the prologue and the epilogue ones, where we see these sort of wall of objects. In the prologue, you're sort of foreshadowing us with what we might meet in the book. And then the epilogue is basically, I could have just not written an epilogue and just had your illustration, because that is it. That sums it up brilliantly.
Please do still read the epilogue. It's brilliant.
I mean, they're all just so fantastic in their own way. I'm really looking forward to our listeners being able to see them.
Brilliant. I think the sugar one's probably amongst my favourites, but my other favourite is the wool sort of illustration as well, where there's almost sections. So it's a picture of someone sort of knitting, but it zooms into sort of different, I guess, levels of the structure of wool. And as sort of a biologist who's also sort of crafted with wool, I really didn't know how complex a material it is until I started on that illustration. And I absolutely love looking at it.
Me too. Yeah. Wool is just the most mind-blowing material ever. Like, the way that it's got all these hierarchies of structure all made up of... I mean, atoms at their most fundamental, but there's like several different layers of structures out of structures out of structures. And yeah, it blows my mind every time. And the fact that you were able to translate that into like a beautiful illustration is just incredible.
I think as a zoologist as well, it's just this thing that, you know, sort of natural selection and evolution has just produced this amazing material that was originally just to keep an animal warm.
and then
we've sort of transformed it into something else. So what are your hopes for, you know, the next few months or longer as this book goes out into the big wide world?
Oh, I'm so excited for people to read it. It's also very scary because it is so autobiographical and people will learn my deepest, darkest, worst traits. But I think, like we said, this is a book that I don't think there are many like this in terms of it being written by someone that, by a voice that isn't traditionally represented in popular science writing. So if there is someone who reads this and feels more confident to become interested in science or become interested in craft, it works both ways equally, then that'll be a really good result. You know, if there's a younger person who is maybe feeling unsure about where they fit in the world, be that because of their sexuality or their interests or, you know, their quirks that they see in themselves, if this book can give them the confidence that that they can exist and succeed, then to me that is good. That's a reason for doing it as well. So I just, yeah, I hope that it touches people, and I hope that they I hope that they let me know, because otherwise I will just be sitting here alone like I have been for a year writing this book. Because it's funny, when you do the sort of, you know, the comedy and the talks and stuff, there's a lot of immediate feedback and dialogue between the audience, whereas with a book, it's very far removed. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I would really love to hear from people who have read it and what they think about it, good and bad. And yeah, I just hope that it touches people in ways that I probably can't even anticipate as well.
So that was the wonderful Hannah Ayoub interviewing me about my book, Handmade, A Scientist's Search for Meaning Through Making, which is out on the 13th of May. You can order hardback and Kindle copies of Handmade online, and there's also an audiobook version. So if that's more your thing, then you can listen to this voice for many, many hours telling stories about materials. That's everything for this episode. As always, it would be awesome if you could like and subscribe to the podcast and review it on Apple Podcasts. If you want to keep up to date with everything that's going on via social media, we're on Twitter at Real Talk, that's R-I-A-L Talk, and on Instagram at Handmade Pod. If you'd like to support with a one-time financial donation, you can do so at supporter.acast.com/handmade. A huge thanks, as always, to Alex Lathbridge for the music mix, and a shout out to our second great rebranding of the podcast, which is now rebranded to more closely align with the front of the book. That's all for this special episode. Next week, I'll be talking to woodworker and all-round craftsperson extraordinaire Daniel Dernan about his life in craft. So until then, take very good care, and I'll speak to you next time on Handmade.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.